From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're watching Greece, where people are lining up at ATMs to withdraw cash as worries of a default loom and a possible Greek exit from the Eurozone. We're going to check in Athens in just a few minutes.
Quite a drama there. But first, the Supreme Court ended its term with three more big decisions, final decisions this morning. In a 5-4 ruling, the court said lethal injections are not a violation of the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. And the court also handed down big rulings on how states can draw up congressional districts and on the Environmental Protection Agency. Emily Bazelon has been watching it all. She's staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
And start with the lethal injection case. This is Glossop v. Gross. Last year, death row inmates argued that the drug midazolam, which was used in three botched executions, was a violation of that constitutional promise of no cruel punishment. Other drugs are not available now. So if the court had agreed with the inmates, they'd effectively be ending lethal injections for now. They didn't agree, though. What did they say?
Well, the majority, and it's by Samuel Alito for the conservatives on the court, argues that because the plaintiffs in this case, the death row inmates, did not identify an alternative means of execution, a different drug, that this kind of lethal injection Oklahoma has been doing has to continue. Essentially, it's an argument that I've never heard before that puts the burden on a death row inmate to say, here's an alternative source for the drug. And that was the basis for the decision.
Well, the Justice Sotomayor in her dissent agreed.
She was very troubled by the notion that a death row inmate should have to identify an alternative means of execution. And she does a very careful reading of the science surrounding this contended drug, midazolam, and is very concerned that it is causing people essentially to be tortured, or at least there's that risk during an execution. Midazolam, we know, renders people unconscious. We don't know whether it continues to maintain the unconscious state. And that is Sotomayor's big concern in her dissent.
Well, then at least one well-documented case, we've reported on it here, it didn't. I mean, somebody was in terrible pain. But also, she also said that, you know, the condemned doesn't have a duty to pick an instrument. But it sounded like Alito was saying capital punishment itself has to be constitutional, but not the means.
Right. I mean, the state of Oklahoma was in a bind here. To back up for a moment, it used to be that the method of lethal injection the states used relied on sedatives that did not raise the same kinds of questions midazolam raised. And then what happened is it became impossible for the states to obtain those drugs. American manufacturers stopped making them. The European companies didn't want to sell them. And so Alito is essentially siding with the states about this dilemma and saying, look, this is the drug they have left. We're going to let them keep using it.
Yeah. So the liberal bloc was seen as having a defeat in this case, but then a victory maybe in the next Arizona state legislature versus Arizona independent redistricting. The four liberal justices plus Anthony Kennedy said Arizona voters had the right to create an independent commission to draw lines for congressional districts. This is as opposed to lawmakers. And in the case of lawmakers, it was often seen as them going off and doing it along party lines.
Right. This is the sleeper case of the term, in my view, because it's about political power. There has been a move in some states to try to take redistricting away from politicians, give it to independent line drawers who presumably won't do the same kind of partisan gerrymandering, which has been so polarizing for the political system. And this one, in a decision by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Kennedy is the swing vote here with the liberals. This one comes out in favor of allowing independent bipartisan commissions to continue to draw these district lines.
Yeah. The third decision, the court dealt a blow to the Obama administration's EPA efforts because the court sided with industry groups and 21 Republican-led states in saying that the EPA has to consider the cost of its proposals. What does this mean? Can an industry say, oh, I can't abide by the EPA because it costs too much?
Well, the funny thing about this decision is that there's a strong dissent here on behalf of the liberals and moderates on the court from Justice Kagan. And what she says is the EPA did take the cost of these regulations into account. They simply did so later in the process than the challengers who were run industrial plants wanted them to do. And so this is a funny case in which, in fact, the government does consider cost. Because if you think about it, it is irrational to impose a regulation if it would do a very tiny amount of good and cost an enormous amount of money. And yet, the conservative majority is sending this back to the drawing board for the Obama administration to do this cost-benefit analysis early on in the regulatory process.
Yeah. Well, in about a minute we have left, just take a step back, and I know there's going to be a lot of ink spilled over this question, but what would you say about the role that Chief Justice John Roberts played this term?
He played a really interesting role. You know, he's the author of the pro-Obamacare decision, coming down for interpreting laws in terms of their purpose, really a very pragmatic move, and yet playing the role of dissenter in the same-sex marriage case, trying to make an argument that stayed away from any kind of taint of anti-gay prejudice and really depended on the democratic process. And so arguably, in both cases, he's talking about the judiciary playing a relatively deferential, limited role compared to Congress and the president.
Yeah, and as you said, there's going to be volumes written on Roberts and his court, and we'll have you back to talk more about that. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School on today's Supreme Court decisions, the final of this term. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get to Athens now, where banks are closed and the government of Greece has imposed limits on cash withdrawals amid fears that Greece will run out of money. The country has to make a 1.6 billion euro payment to the International Monetary Fund by tomorrow. And the Wall Street Journal and other news organizations are now reporting that the government does not intend to make that payment. That would put Greece in default. And it raises concerns that the country could leave the eurozone. The crisis has sent markets in Europe falling today and here in the U.S. as European officials blamed Greece for the situation. Jean-Claude Juncker is head of the European Commission. Here he is speaking through a translator.
And after all my efforts and the efforts made by the Commission and by other institutions involved in the process, I feel a little betrayed because not due consideration is being given to my personal efforts and the efforts of others.
Adding to the Greek drama, the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, is calling for a referendum this weekend, giving the Greek people a chance to weigh in on the bailout and whether Greece should stay in the eurozone. The BBC's Lucy Burton joins us from Athens. And Lucy, first, just what's the scene there today?
Well, do you know what, Jeremy? I think it's fair to say that people are very confused and they're very angry. We've seen people still queuing outside banks, hoping that they might be able to get in and trying to get to their bank accounts. Now, we know that the capital controls that the Greek government have imposed means that people can only take out 60 euros a day. Now, people are very worried that even within the banks, that cash might run out. So we've certainly seen long queues. And within those queues, people are, A, very worried. They don't know what's going to happen over the next week. And they're also very angry. They're saying, some of them, that Mr. Tsipras shouldn't have put this responsibility of a referendum on their shoulders. They're saying things like, Mr. Tsipras was voted to be prime minister. And like a ship's captain, he shouldn't start asking his passengers to sail the ship.
Well, and what about that referendum? Is it likely, or is the expectation in Greece that the Greek people will vote yes, accept the bailout, or no, don't accept it?
Do you know what? The really interesting thing about the situation here at the moment is that people are highly politicized and they are split down both lines. It is very, very, very difficult to call. The people that are pro-Europe are vehemently campaigning that a no vote would really mean, you know, economic catastrophe, if you like, and saying that we don't know what would happen the week after. Would businesses be able to open? Would banks be able to open? They are very strongly campaigning that being in Europe is best. But then equally, on the other side of the argument, the people that have coped with 5 years of really crippling austerity say, we've tried the European approach. It hasn't worked. Perhaps, just maybe, we'll be able to do better on our own.
What is the political fallout if Greece has to leave the euro? What happens across Europe? Spain has already come out and said we can withstand a Grexit, as they're calling it, a Greek exit. But there's a question about the UK potentially, looking at their own membership in the European Union. What happens across Europe the day after if Greece does leave?
Jeremy, the political fallout of a Grexit, a Greek exit from the eurozone, could really be catastrophic for the Euro project as a whole. Now, we already have smaller parties in southern Mediterranean countries who are aligned with Syriza, who think that austerity has squeezed the economy too much and people simply can't live like that anymore. I'm thinking particularly of Podemos in Spain, and there are parties in Italy as well. Now, should Greece leave, because the people have spoken in, you know, the absolute sort of moment of democracy here in Greece, politicians, centrist politicians in those countries will be very worried indeed. And the smaller, more anti-austerity parties will only gain in popularity. And of course, in the next 2 years in Great Britain, we also have a referendum on EU membership. And if Greece leaves, perhaps followed by other southern Mediterranean countries, The project as a whole, which of course is still a fairly young coalition if you think about it, seems a lot less attractive than it did once before.
And now a story you have to hear. You have to hear this. It's about Frank Isaac. He's 83 and still owns and runs a yoga studio in Rancho Santa Fe, California, giving free yoga instruction to seniors and worthy students since 2003. Isn't that cool? It is. But that's not the story. The story is that Frank Isaac also took part in the first ever airplane hijacking. The year was 1956, his goal to escape from communist-controlled Hungary. But what about the KGB agent and the Soviet MiGs and the Alps? It's a humdinger of a story, and he tells it in his self-published memoir and soon, fingers crossed, a movie. We read about all of this in the San Diego Union-Tribune, and Frank Isaac joins us from KPBS in San Diego. Welcome.
Hello, Robin. Nice hearing from you.
Well, wonderful to speak with you. Tell us this story. Go back nearly 60 years. The Communist Party takes over Hungary in 1949. You're 18. Your father, a railroad watchman. Your mom, a farm laborer. You're a boxer, but you want to be a writer. What do party members tell you?
That we don't need no writers. We need chemical engineers. Hmm. So you're going to be a chemical engineer, Frank Isaac, or else.
Yeah. They send you to the University of Chemical Engineering, but you also started writing for a newspaper, but they didn't like what you wrote.
I just couldn't deny my callings. Yeah. So, and that was very interesting because sometimes bad things happen for some good come out of them. They kicked me out of the university because of my journalistic activities were more important to me than studying chemistry.
Well, you also got sent to a uranium mine.
Somehow I managed myself into a uranium mine as a labor force, and I worked there until about 9 months, and then I escaped from them, and from there on it was running. How fast can I run ahead of them?
Right. Well, and that alone is a story. You find a job at a brick factory near Budapest, but then you start meeting the people who will become your cohorts, someone who's a former fighter pilot being punished for refusing to join the Communist Party. What did you all talk about?
How to escape. The dream of that era of my generation was how to get out of here, how to escape, how to leave the land of this darkness and hopelessness. And there was no way because the Iron Curtain was so impregnable, was built with such a powerful system that it was absolutely impossible to escape. Yeah. So I talked to George, my co-conspirator, that, how about escaping? George says, you know it's impossible. You can't crawl under the wires. I said, but you can fly over the wires. Hmm. And then that's when the conspiracy began. And then we have to recruit people because we had to take over the aircraft. It had to be only a domestic airline because you couldn't get on an international airline. And the domestic airline was going to go toward the west, and that's where we wanted to go, but a little bit further than the plane originally was planned. Meaning that...
So, yes, you had to think through what kind of plane to get, and you were, as you say, going to take it further than it had planned. This was an officially sanctioned flight to a tournament near Hungary's western border in 1956, July 13th. So you board the plane, you, these new friends of yours, your wife. By the way, wasn't anyone afraid?
Scared to hell. We made a decision that if we are going to capture it, but if there is a way to commit suicide, we'd rather do that than being captured alive. Hmm. Because it's going to be execution anyway, and that we just didn't want to go through the torture.
So you have a plan to commit group suicide if this doesn't work, but meanwhile, it starts to happen. Now, the storyline dovetails off and splinters into a couple of different places, but they're all incredible. At a certain signal, George, the former fighter pilot, he was supposed to go take a wrench and open the cockpit door. Others were going to go search because you thought there might be a KGB agent aboard.
Okay. We were start knocking people out because we didn't know which one of those passengers, there were 10 passengers, which one of them is a secret policeman. One of them for sure, we knew that.
You're knocking them out.
Oh, I have to. We just have to disarm them. So everybody was knocked out. Some of them was fighting back. And they made a lot of noise. Somebody opens the cockpit door from the inside, looks out. The plane the next moment goes into a nosedive, dropping hundreds of feet and then bouncing and then coming up again, bouncing up and down. Everybody was flying up and down in the plane. And George is trying to open the door. He eventually cracked it open with a screwdriver, actually.
What does he find?
He opens the door and he goes in and he expects to find four people. And instead of four, there were five. The secret policeman was the fifth man, with a loaded gun waiting for somebody to enter. And as he did, he pulled the trigger and the gun misfired.
No.
Yes. He pulled the trigger, bingo, nothing happens.
So that's stroke of luck number, I think, six we're on.
there is absolutely no way to even construct any more incredible story that how many things had to stay in line and happen the way it happened.
George's gun isn't a real gun. He's holding up a gun, but that's not a real gun, right?
Correct. It won't fire.
So what does he do? He's a boxer. What does he do?
Jumps the cop. Jumps the cop. He's now the cop is on his back on the small cockpit, and George is on top of him, and three people, the co-pilot, the engineer, and the radio man, pounding his head with anything they could get their hands on. He's bleeding like a pig.
Didn't they at this point throw the plane in a dive?
Oh, the plane came from 8,000 feet to 400 feet, ready to crash land. And then by the time George got the gun from the secret policeman and fired two shots into the ceiling, ready to crash land, George takes over the plane.
Oh my gosh. And you, the team, you pin down the agents and the crew.
Right. And then I look out the cockpit window and there are two jets on top of us.
Oh. That's right. Now we have two MiGs.
Two MiG-17s.
Oh, boy. So these Soviet planes are now following you. You're still in Hungarian airspace.
Well, passing the Iron Curtain.
But you make it out of Hungarian airspace. The Soviet MiGs have to turn back. And then the fuel gauge is empty.
There are several choices that you end up without navigation, which we had none. Austria, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, or West Germany. So you fly 285 and you end up hopefully in West Germany if you have enough fuel to fly through the Alps. But then what happened? The door to the outside was cracked open, so we couldn't close it fully. So the plane had to stay at 10,000 feet and we started to run into thunderstorms. Sometimes I looked out the window, it was as close to the next mountain than I ever wanted to see. So we're flying through the Alps for an hour and a half. Without any navigation, total soup, 10,000 feet, when the mountains could be 11,000 feet. And then eventually we ran out of fuel. So now you have to do whatever. To descend from 10,000 feet to 300 and some, which we finally broke out of the clouds, is the most harrowing experience you can even dream of.
Well, you don't know if you're going to hit a mountain, and further, you don't know if you're going to be landing inside free West Germany or be trapped in East Germany.
So the first step was we broke out of the car, and guess what? There was an airport right below us. A runway, not an airport. As if it was ordered to be there.
And
so we turned around and we land.
And
where did we land? Is it East Germany? Is it Czechoslovakia? Is it Austria? All three of them would return us to Hungary. And I'm sitting there with my wife in front of me. Her leg is broken in two pieces through the bouncing of the plane event. And nobody around, not even a wind sack, except from the end of the runway, something moves. And that's a jeep. And it's coming closer and closer. We can see the machine gun mounted on the back of the jeep. And then I had the gun at that time and I slowly brought it to the back of my wife's head. If the wrong place, I prayed God to give me strength to pull my index finger to end it. The jeep turns around, simultaneously my wife asking me, honey, where are we? And the jeep had the answer. Stars and Stripes.
Ah.
NATO Air Force. Excuse me. 59 years later, I'm still emotional.
Yeah.
NATO Air Force Base under construction.
It was NATO.
Construction in West Germany, Ingolstadt. I was born. I felt a distinct feeling that nobody ever had, being born at age 25.
Yeah. Well, and so close to pulling that trigger, not knowing where you were.
Yeah.
Well, I just, and of course, saved by the people in that Jeep with the U.S. Stars and Stripes. You have resettled, all of you resettled in the U.S. The first hijacking ever. So long ago, how often do you think of that?
All the time. It's just with me. It's I don't know how to tell you, but it became the existence of me, starting with that moment. You either submit and you live as a slave, or you are taking whatever you have to take to be free.
Frank, thank you so much for telling your story to us.
I enjoyed talking with Robin.
Frank Isaac, who carried out the first ever airline hijacking to escape communist Hungary in 1956. His self-published memoir is titled Free for All to Freedom. Now, you may be saying, why haven't I heard this story? Well, filmmaker André Hulls, a native of Hungary, says it's because shortly after, in 1956, there was an attempted revolution, protesters trying to topple the government. They were crushed by Soviet tanks, a Moscow-approved regime installed, and that wiped out everything else. But also, Frank Isaac left just in time. And Hulls hopes to make his story into a movie. Stay tuned.
Three big stories roiling financial markets today. There is Greece, where banks and markets are closed after debt negotiations were derailed. There's Puerto Rico, which is struggling with its own debt crisis. And then there is China, where stocks are down sharply today. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News joins us with more on all of this. And Jill, let's start with Greece. And there are so many moving parts here. They owe a couple of billion dollars just about to the IMF by tomorrow. It looks like they're not going to make that payment. The banks are closed. There's a referendum set for this weekend on whether to accept the terms of the bailout. But what are you watching as you look at Greece right now?
Well, I think we really have to target Sunday, and that's the vote, the referendum. And that, remember, this is some crazy story because Saturday, 1 a.m., the prime minister of Greece goes on television and says, there's going to be election next week. I'm not making this decision about the bailout. You guys are.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating about that is that, remember, he was elected on a platform which basically was, I am not going to accept any more austerity, no more belt tightening here in Greece. We've done enough. And now he's actually faced with this dilemma of whether to accept that in order to get money from the European lenders. And at this point, it may be that the Greek people say, hey, you know what? We know the euro. We don't want to leave the euro. So even though we hate austerity, we'll actually give you the thumbs up. But again, this is not going to happen till Sunday. The main point being that you'll be enjoying your barbecue and I'll be watching that vote.
Well, and when that happens, is that the earliest that we could see a move? Let's say that they say we don't want to accept the terms of the bailout. Is there any chance that Greece would have to leave the euro before then?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think there's – I mean, if we don't see a payment tomorrow to the IMF,
yeah.
What happens is they're in technical default to the IMF, not to the other European lenders, not to the ECB, not to the EC, and not to the credit rating industry. That's really interesting because the credit raters are not going to call them technically in default, so they can keep going for a few days. But again, it's going to be a painful few days for the Greeks.
Okay, and what about Puerto Rico, which has got its own debt crisis going on? The governor there told the New York Times that Puerto Rico cannot pay its $72 billion of debt. There are still negotiations going on, but the budget has to be approved by tomorrow. What's likely to happen there?
This is a very interesting one because here's the differentiation between, say, Puerto Rico and then we look back to, say, Detroit. Puerto Rico cannot declare bankruptcy.
Right.
They are not allowed under Chapter 9 of the IRS code. So when they say we can't pay you, it's not as if they can say we're declaring bankruptcy and everyone will fight over it. Really, what has to happen right now is Puerto Rico goes to the bondholders. And remember, those bondholders, about half of whom are mutual funds, which many of the high taxpayers in this country have been investing in. They go to those mutual funds, they go to the bondholders, and they say, hey, we owe you 72. How about you take 36? And that's really what that negotiation is going to come down to.
Okay, we'll be watching that. And real quick, what's going on in China? Big drop in the stock market there.
You know what happens when a stock market doubles in a year? You get a little sell-off. Okay, so we are down. We are actually in a bear market. We're 22% lower. This is totally a story of euphoria and a little bit of taking a prick of that bubble. The Chinese government is trying to take a step and say, hey, we'll cut rates. But honestly, when you double something in a year, to have a 20% sell-off doesn't seem unreasonable. A lot of people have been expecting this.
All right. Well, we will be watching all three of these stories. Jill Schlesinger of CBS News. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
So, did the Earth shift on its axis last week? As George Stephanopoulos noted on ABC, the week began with a call to take down the Confederate flag and ended with the raising of rainbow flags. But we also watched a black president eulogize African Americans gunned down by white supremacist hatred, a reminder that taking down a flag doesn't really bury the past. And over the weekend, foes of marriage equality pledged to fight the Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage in the same way they see pro-life activists successfully eroding the court's Roe v. Wade decision, legalizing abortion, bit by bit and slowly over time. So how important and enduring will last week be when viewed by history? Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. His most recent book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. Boy, if ever one man was viewed in different ways over time, it's Johnson. Julian joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And so what say you about last week? Some are saying they don't recall a week like it for lurching change from, as we said, the flag to the Supreme Court decisions.
Well, it was certainly an important week for liberals. You have gains in civil rights with same-sex marriage. You had the protection of certain social policies, both ACA and the Fair Housing Act. And you obviously had a president who seemed energized and moved and talking and speaking with a kind of spirit that he seems to have lacked for a while. So it was an important week. These gains are enormous and very significant. But I do think, as you suggested, you could see some underlying limits to the gains of the week and some potential backlash areas where the politics will continue to play out.
Well, first, before we go there, talk about other times where, weeks that occur to you, those of us with shorter memories, but weeks that were as big as this or bigger.
Well, certainly the first few months of 1965 are in many ways like this if you were liberal. This is after Democrats have landslide victories for the presidency and Congress in 64, and they're passing all kinds of bills at that time, Medicare, education reform, voting rights, and much more. And it seemed like if you were liberal in Congress, there had never been a time like this and that your opponents were on the defensive. So that took place over a series of months, but the feeling of euphoria was very similar.
Well, you say if you're a liberal, what if you're not? What if you are conservative? Is there a resonating week that matches this one?
Well, certainly you can pick a week between 1933 and 1935 when Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic Congress start to remake what the government does and how much regulation you're going to have in the economy, ending in 1935 with the government giving legitimacy to unions, where many business leaders who were on the conservative end of the spectrum felt that the country was falling apart, felt that we were on the way to a socialist government, and felt that the time had come to really start to fight back. So that or the mid-1960s, conservatives certainly didn't see it with the same euphoria as the left.
Oh, but that's what I'm saying. Is there a week that conservatives can point to in history and have that same feeling of change in their direction?
Sure. July, it's a few weeks, but July and early August of 1965, again, Medicare, voting rights, a huge expansion of the federal government taking place between the start of the summer and the end in a way that many conservatives didn't think was possible just a few years earlier.
Well, and so I think I'm perhaps not making my point, but you seem to be making it for us. We're asking, is there a week that conservatives can point to and say they've had equally big wins
in
history?
Sure. In 1981, I can't remember the exact week off the top of my head, when Reagan passes a huge tax cut after being elected, after conservatives are wondering what will he do, and he slashes the income tax. Many conservatives thought this was just a huge moment where the government was finally doing the right thing, eliminating parts of itself. So I think that was a big time for the right.
Right. A lot of celebration. But as you point to each of these, in many cases, there's also change that comes after change. So talk about what might happen now. And then calls, for instance, for overturning Obamacare. Let's start there. The New York Times' David Leonhardt asked historians, and they pointed to Reconstruction, the move after the Civil War to re-enslave blacks, literally, through Jim Crow laws. But other than that, they said, you know, government mandates like Obamacare tend to endure. Your sense of history in that?
It's usually the case, not always the case. So in the mid-1960s, we had a model cities program, which provided federal funding to cities to try new projects to renew the inner city. And gradually, they became very controversial and faded away. In the Reagan presidency, in 1988, Congress passes a program, Medicare Catastrophic Care, which ultimately is dismantled the year after when there's such a backlash against it. So there are smaller examples than Reconstruction when government doesn't endure. Social Security for the first 15 years of its life was very small and it was almost dying by 1950. It was almost a program that was going to go away. And it took a lot of a big fight to get it to be what it is today. So it's true, generally, once programs, big programs are in place, they're hard to take away. But I would be careful to say it's impossible because we have examples of that.
Well, and some people think we are watching one right now. There's a call from conservatives like 33-year-old Ryan Anderson. He's at the Heritage Foundation. He says for people who are against the Supreme Court's marriage decision, look to pro-lifers. They put their hand to the plow, he writes. We are the fruit, young conservatives who are more against abortion than their parents. And he says the pro-life community stood up, responded to a bad court ruling, again meaning Roe v. Wade, and the same must now be done to dismantle same-sex marriage over time. Tell us more about what history says about dismantling programs.
Well, we've seen it with abortion where the right to abortion remains on the books, but the restrictions on using federal money, for example, for the provision of abortions has really been constrained since the mid-1970s. Conservatives have been very successful through that, through restrictions at the state and local level. And I think that's the kind of fight that you're going to see now, not necessarily on same-sex marriage, but issues like what kinds of benefits should be accorded to couples and workplace regulations. There's all kinds of areas that are unsettled. So we saw that with civil rights. Look, another area where policy was dismantled is the Voting Rights Act, which is no longer intact because of a Supreme Court ruling. So we've seen conservatives fight slow, gradual fights, and often they can at least chip away at major reforms, even if they can't get rid of them.
Well, and this brings us to President Obama's legacy and the lasting nature of his wins last week. Here's Newt Gingrich yesterday on Meet the Press. He had an exchange with the host, Chuck Dodd.
I think Obama has an enormous investment in the 2016 presidential campaign because he could be Franklin Roosevelt and change things permanently. Or he could be Woodrow Wilson and within 2 or 3 years have an amazing part of what he thinks.
Look, Ronald Reagan needed H.W. Bush to win that third term. Barack Obama needs Hillary Clinton for the same thing. All right. I got a little fun thing here for everybody.
So, again, Chuck Todd with Newt Gingrich making the point that, again, what you're talking about, this the lasting nature of something might have something to do with the next presidency.
The next presidency and the next Congress. I think that's very important. You can even see it with President Obama. A lot of President Bush's counterterrorism program has remained intact, in part because a Democratic president left a lot of it in place. So what comes next, both in the White House and on Capitol Hill, will Republican majorities shrink? Will Democrats be able to regain control of the Senate? Those are going to be enormously important questions for what the quote-unquote legacy of this president is.
And, you know, another factor, people change. We see that with President Obama, who was once against same-sex marriage, now for, again, reading David Leonhardt, reminds us that Ronald Reagan made his bones, his conservative bones, on vowing to repeal Medicare, and then he pledges to preserve it years later.
Right. What happens are programs, once they're in effect, look much more appealing. Often conservatives don't feel politically they can attack them anymore. And many of their friends and many people in their community like the program. So Medicare was socialized medicine in 1965. Fast forward to 2010, and you have conservatives telling Obama, get your government hands off my Medicare. And that's not an uncommon story. So I think as the program kicks in, as the benefits start to disperse, that will give President Obama's programs the greatest traction.
Professor Julian Zelizer of Princeton, taking a look at the last week through an historian's viewpoint. Julian, thanks as always.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that Hawaii's power grid is running into some problems. Right now, 21% of that state's power comes from wind and solar. A new state law requires that all of the state's electricity come from renewables by 2045. Well, according to the Journal, Hawaii's main utility is struggling to deal with the erratic delivery of power from the solar and wind sources that are pumping power into the utility. More than 50,000 houses with rooftop solar panels put any unused electricity into the grid. Mark Glick of the Hawaii State Energy Office says these issues will be worked through and Hawaii will eventually be energy self-reliant. So that's one vision of the energy future. Another is happening in Fort Collins, Colorado. Reporter Dan Boyce from Here and Now contributor Inside Energy has that story.
I'm Kara Neth, and right now our house is 68 degrees.
A temperature like that is actually a big deal for Kara and her husband, Torger Haugen. Just a couple of months ago, they would struggle to get the thermostat up to 50 or 60.
I wear a hat and a coat all the time.
Huddling under blankets, faulty ducts were essentially pumping heat out into the dirt around their home.
Really uncomfortable. Unlivable, really.
Now the couple pulls open a trap door in their closet.
So what you're seeing down there is the new ductwork,
revealing the results of a more than $13,000 heating system upgrade.
It's changed our lives.
Kara and Torger's Fort Collins home is one piece of our potential utility of the future. Stay with me. It'll make more sense if I back up and explain the other pieces first. John Phelan is driving me to piece number one.
I'm energy services manager here at Fort Collins Utilities.
The city government runs a small municipal utility, and the installation of this first piece happened about 3 years ago. Around the back of his home, there it is.
Got your basic gray box on the side of the house.
A smart meter in all its splendor.
Looks sort of normal.
Boring. Yeah. Looks boring.
Yeah.
The city has installed about 70,000 of these things. Now, both customers and the utility can see their energy use in 15-minute increments versus once a month before. Dennis Sumner is senior electrical engineer with Fort Collins Utilities.
I think of this as a paradigm-shifting investment.
But that paradigm shift, it really hasn't happened yet in most places.
Of itself, it doesn't generate energy. Of itself, it doesn't reduce energy use.
But the data these smart meters supply provides a foundation Fort Collins needs. Here's why. Local elected leaders set a goal for the city to be carbon neutral by 2050. Right now, the utility gets the vast majority of its power from coal, so that's an ambitious target.
It's going to take a lot of work.
Leading to the second piece of our utility of the future, choice. Fort Collins needs two more things to accomplish its climate goals. Residents need to use less energy, and the city needs to get that energy from many more places, from community solar gardens, rooftop solar, wind power. All that's going to change the relationship people have with the utility. Under the current model, they bring us electricity, and we pay for it. Sumner says in the future,
we can tailor the delivery. Customer can decide their own package that they want.
Customers will buy and sell electricity on the grid, zapping energy back and forth from their solar panels or stored in their electric cars.
It's a marketplace.
James Tong is with the group Clean Power Finance. He predicts the grid of the future will work like an app store. Utilities
provide the hardware that hosts the platform, but they also curate the vendors.
The only way Fort Collins will keep this energy transition affordable is if the citizens buy into renewables and, more importantly, make their homes as energy efficient as possible. Fort Collins is trying to spur residents to action through the final piece of our utility of the future, financing. Which brings us back to Kara and Torgers.
We couldn't have gotten it done without the city's help.
They didn't have the $13,000 to upgrade their heating, but the utility did. Customers can borrow from Fort Collins Utilities to pay for energy efficiency projects or renewables like solar. Kara and Torger make payments right on their monthly utility bill and say in the wintertime they will save money.
Because we're not using 6 space heaters spread all over the house.
Energy researchers at the Rocky Mountain Institute say Fort Collins is the first utility in the country to offer real long-term loans at attractive rates, all to get customers to make these upgrades and keep monthly bills low. Energy Services Manager John Phelan says they'll need everything at their disposal to push toward this utility of the future.
There is no silver bullet. What we need are silver BBs.
Fort Collins hopes all these BBs bundled up will keep them in business in a changing world of electricity. It's an experiment in grid innovation many in the industry are watching closely. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
And Dan's story comes to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.